Hey there, Nerd Clan. This episode of the Potterverse is brought to you by MinuteWithMary.com. Now listen, a lot of us are wearing masks, right? It's just whether you have to wear it at work or when you run errands, it is what it is. And because of that, there's something happening. It's called mask-ny.
What is it called?
Knee.
Mask knee?
It's like acne from your mask.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's wretched, okay? I know a lot of you know what I'm talking about. Those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, just you wait. Just you wait. I'm telling you, it may happen. Now, I have lots of tips and tricks that I'm actually going to be sharing in my VIP group on Facebook. If you're not yet there, search the hashtag Minute with Mary. The group is free. I share tons of tips and tricks. And I'm here, of course, if you ever have any beauty needs, MinuteWithMary.com. But seriously, join my VIP group because I've got some mask need tips.
Did you ever make anything happen? Anything you couldn't explain? You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
In a few moments, you will pass through these doors and join your classmates.
Keep an eye on the staircases. They like to change.
Good afternoon, class. Welcome to your first flying lesson. Stick your right hand over the broom and say up.
Mr. Longbottom, exactly where do you think you're going?
Do you really have the scar?
Yes, man, I do.
Wicked.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
First years should note that the Dark Forest is strictly forbidden, that no magic is to be used between the classes in the corridors.
Petrificus Totalus.
The third floor corridor is out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to suffer a most painful death.
Throw in the dungeon!
Understand this, Harry, because it's very important. Not all wizards are good.
I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed. Or worse, expelled.
So good. She needs to sort out her priorities.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you.
Yeah, baby. The magic begins now. Woo! From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to the Potterverse. It's a podcast dedicated to the book and film universe of Harry Potter. So grab your favorite wands and your time turners, and let's step into the night and pursue that flighty temptress adventure. And welcome. My name is Mary Larson.
My name is Blake, and I've been waiting for this moment. I've been waiting. I'm ready. I'm ready to talk about this film. I'm ready to talk about it on so many different levels.
Yes.
It may blow your mind. It may. I don't You're know.
Always the most humble Slytherins are. Yes. Okay. So, of course, tonight in this episode, we are talking about the film Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. We are so excited to talk about this, but we wanted to remind you all that we actually recorded a full commentary track. Blake and I watched the movie last night prior to us recording this podcast, and we recorded it. Granted, it was on our phones. It's not as fancy schmancy. We didn't do it in our podcast studio, but you can actually check that out. by heading to jointhenerdclan.com.
Yeah, go there and you can check out everything that we have while you're there. I mean, including all of the Harry Potter content that we have, all of the Outlander content. I mean, it's really great. So you go there and it just says Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone commentary track. And we actually did put it up on the first 10 minutes or so. We put it up on the podcast feed.
Oh, I was wondering because I thought it came up, showing that he was there.
The first 10 minutes or so are on the podcast feed. So if you listen to it for 10 minutes and then it stopped, that's because it's a premium content.
But you didn't say, hi, this is ending?
I put it in the notes.
Oh, okay.
So like it says, hey, this is premium. It's a premium preview.
Yeah.
But so, you know, a lot of people don't pay attention to the title. They just see, you know, commentary track and then that's that. So I wanted to make everybody aware that the first 10 minutes are available. So you get a flavor of what it's like, what we were doing, how we were trying to do it.
Nice.
And the full version of it is at jointhenerdclan.com.
Amazing. And of course, we wanted to remind you to hit subscribe on this podcast. Tell your friends. The best way to learn about podcast is actually through a friend. It's through word of mouth. So sharing the podcast in one way, shape, or form is great. You can also find us at Mary and Blake on social media. Go to maryandblake.com to find all of our podcasts and blogs. And once again, if this brings you joy, if it brings Lumos in the time of Nox for you, please head on over to jointhenerdclan.com. It just got a facelift, that website did.
Yes,
so
it did.
Check it on out. And there, for as little as $2 a month, you can contribute to make this all possible. But for now, let's get into the show.
I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good.
All right, Blake.
Are we going to do the quick question of the day? We were supposed to do that.
Oh, sorry about that. What is the quick question of the day?
We were supposed to talk about the quick question of the day before we got into it.
It's all good.
It does say in the Google Doc, Mary.
Sorry about that. Anyway,
what is a quick question of the day?
What do you most look forward to in this movie?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a good question. Mainly because I wrote it.
You did write this question.
I did write the question. So then, you know what? I will ask you, Mary. What do you most look forward to when you think about this movie? What is it that you cannot wait to see when you watch it?
So when I first saw the movie, of course, I had read books 1 through 4, and what I was most looking forward to was actually seeing Quidditch, because I could not visually conceptualize that in my head when I was reading it. It sounded very interesting, but I wanted to see what it looked like on screen. However, now after watching it a million times, what I look most forward to viewing in this movie is Diagon Alley. Because I love seeing all the shops and seeing all the little bits. Like, you just want to pause the movie as they're walking down that street to see everything that they've done. They've even said that each of the shopkeepers, they made it so personalized. Like, you're, you know, the robe fitter, and this is what you do, and this is, you know, your persona or whatever. So even though you really don't get to know those people, you don't get to meet, for example, Madame Malkin, that there were people cast as that, and they got really into the character. And I just love seeing that, because you can tell that alley brought so much joy. I was actually reading that when J.K. when the author came to the set of Diagon Alley, she cried because it was so perfect.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So
that's what I look forward to most currently now when I watch it, is just the little bits that I see in Diagon Alley.
Quick fun trivia. The guys who did the set design.
The people.
Well, it's actually a guy who did the set design. The crew of this film is a legit. Well, the person who got credit, the major credit for it.
Of course it was a guy.
The crew that was brought onto this film is a legit crew. The costuming came from the lady came from this movie called The Little Princess. The other major facets, like the cinematography, the set design, all that stuff, came from The English Patient. You know, that film won Best Picture. Like, and then of course Chris Columbus. A lot of people were involved in this film that were legit. So that is, there's a reason why the set design is so good, right? For me, I think my favorite part, the part that I look most forward to, I think it's Ollivander's.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going to explain why in my GBG a little bit further down the road here, but I really look forward to Ollivander's just because it's so, how it's handled is so interesting. And I love that part myself. So everybody who was watching us live on the all the social medias, please tell us what you look most forward to. And if you're watching, if you're listening to us on the podcast app, send us an email, maryandblakemedia@gmail.com. Tell us, let us know. And any of the questions or any of the comments that you have, we'll make sure we put it up here on the podcast. Mm-hmm. So for now, though, Mary, now the quick question of the day is out of the way. Why don't we talk about the director? Of course, the director was Chris Columbus.
Which, like, who gives their kid that name?
I know. Like, but you know his production company is called 1492 Pictures?
Okay. At least he rolls with it.
Team Captain Obvious. Thanks, yes. Chris. Good job. Chris Columbus is kind of a journeyman director, someone along the lines of like Joe Johnston and those. He's like an acolyte of Steven Spielberg.
Okay.
Someone that is of that school. Okay. Of some in that vein of that directorial style.
Yeah.
And he has done many movies, including the Home Alone films, the first two. He also did Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh my gosh, so good.
The movie 9 Months, Stepmom, and then also Bicentennial Man. And then he's also kind of taken a little bit of a step back as of late, though he did the movie I Love You, Beth Cooper, and Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Oh, I didn't know he did that too.
That was his film. Okay. The writer is Steve Kloves. Steve Kloves is basically the mastermind. Steve Kloves. And he's basically the mastermind of the Harry Potter franchise. He has written all of them except for Order of the Phoenix. That's the only one he did not write.
Why not?
I don't know. That's the only one he did not write. He also wrote The Amazing Spider-Man, the one with the one that was super emo, that came out right before they rebooted it with Marvel.
Okay.
And he is also going to be the writer for the third Fantastic Beasts film. He is taking the place of the author of this series. And she actually chose Steve Kloves in the beginning to write this film. That was her hand-picked choice, Steve Kloves. Huh. So that is that. Mary, what's your lightning bolt rating? How many bolts are you giving it?
Oh, my goodness. I'm giving it a 4.9 for this movie.
Okay.
4.9 out of a scale of 1 to 5. I just think that it's iconic. I think that it brought this world to life, that there were so many musical themes. The casting was done for this film. You know, they were able to stick with, for the most part, these actors throughout the films. The set design was created mostly during these films. I just think that, yes, a lot of the children's acting is children's acting. It's not perfect. Mm-hmm. Yes, they were still figuring out their groove with a few things, but in a sense, this movie is iconic and it set the scene literally and figuratively for the rest of the series. So because of that, it's a 4.9. How about you?
For me, I'm giving this one a 4.3. I really like this film. I love the wonderment of this film. I think that's something.
It's a good word for it.
Yeah, I think that's something that Chris Columbus really gets. I think it's something that he really tries his best to achieve. And a perfect example of that, Mary, is what you said earlier. You look at Diagon Alley, and it is a whirlwind when you are in Diagon Alley mm-hmm. with Harry. And the attention to detail is sprawling. It never ceases to amaze. And actually, oddly enough, this film, and funnily enough, it reminds me of Hook.
I love Hook.
I know. And I love Hook as well. I love that film, but it's a terrible film. And I know that.
It's not.
It is. It's a bad film.
It got such bad ratings.
It's a bad film, and that's okay. That's okay. It really is okay that it's a bad film. No, I'm not saying that.
But like, what makes it bad?
Oh, the characterizations.
In Hook?
Yeah, in Hook. And the story, and how.
Can we just say that it's simple?
No, I think it was bad.
I love that.
But. And I'm not saying Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is bad, but the wonderment of it all it reminds me of Hook. And I know full well that Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is not the best movie of all time, but I can separate my love of the film from the overall quality of the film. I mean, I feel like it was, it's episodic. It's, mm-hmm. it's chopped up. It doesn't feel like there's a continuous through line. I feel like it's almost made for TV where it's made to have commercials.
Oh, okay.
And, but I think at the same time, it is so beautifully shot and it is so, the characters are so wonderfully brought to life. And because of that, I really appreciate this film. So I'm giving it a 4.3. What do you got for your GBGs?
Okay, my GBGs, my good, my bad, and my greats. And for those of you joining us live, please include your GBGs in the comments below. It always makes it so fun. My good is the acting by Rupert Grint. I just think all of the children actors, you know, they brought such wonder to the scenes, to the screen. But Rupert Grint, it just seemed to come so naturally. He just has this comedic side to him. He always makes the most perfect facial expressions. There's never really a point in the film where I feel like he is acting, where I feel like it was, you know, okay, this was the 100th take and Chris Columbus had to like remind him of his lines. Like, I just feel like he, it just flowed easily for him. So his acting was my good. My bad is, it's not even bad, but it's just me and my brain is that I cannot unsee the little things that I now see, such as faux grid, which Blake and I have so lovingly called fake Hagrid. Like the fact that the letters when they come out of the fireplace aren't letters at all. They're just sheets of paper with printing on both sides to make it look like it's an envelope, because obviously the envelopes wouldn't fly around in the air and they need light paper. The poor moments of the children's acting, bless their little 10 or 11 year old hearts. Like, because I've now seen this film so many times, there are these little things and I'm like, there it is. Oh gosh. And I can't unsee it, but it's not, I mean, I get this a 4.9. I mean, that's, you know, it's not even necessarily a bad, it's just me. And then my great, it's honestly the same great as the book's great overall. It's the fact that the people, the smells, the places of the Wizarding World were introduced, and the things that I couldn't understand were easier for me to grasp because I could see them on screen. The vastness of the castle, you know, they describe it in so many lengths about how big it is, what it was like on the boats looking up at the castle when they arrived, what it was like on the trolley and the chocolate frog jumping out, things like that that you can envision, but seeing it on screen just made it very fun. So those are my GBGs. How about you?
Oh, my good. I think my good has to begin with Ollivander's. Everything that I mean, John Hurt as Ollivander, he brings a sort of dread and whimsy to Ollivander that I didn't expect. But at the same time, I did expect because of the book, now that I've gotten a chance to read it. But everything with Ollivander's, it felt sacred. It felt almost dangerous. It felt like... There were bigger things at hand when you're in Ollivander's. That I remember we were in the commentary track, we were making fun of all of the wands that hadn't even been touched. He needed somebody to clean it. Yes. Those details that were there, all the dust, the cobwebs, everything, and the feel of it, how he kind of shows up out of nowhere, the lighting when he looks back at Harry and says, "I wonder." Mm-hmm. Like, that is tremendous stuff when you get a chance to just see what it feels like to be in Ollivander's, and you get a chance to feel like what it's like to interact with him and sense how sacred this wand process really is. Ollivander's is great, and I just love watching John Hurt as Ollivander. He is just the best in this first movie. The bad for me, does Quidditch in this movie kind of feel like pod racing in Wars, The Phantom Menace?
No, it doesn't feel like that at all to me.
It kind of feels like pod racing to me.
In what way?
In a sense that it takes the movie. I know there are a bunch of people that love the pod racing in The Phantom Menace. I get it. I truly do. I think it sucks. I hate watching the pod racing. And whenever I watch that film, I force myself to watch the entire thing, but that's the one part that I fast forward. I skip over every single time because it doesn't do anything. It doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't teach me anything about Anakin. The idea of it is that you're supposed to understand that Anakin can use the Force, but at no point do you have any clue that he's using the Force to actually operate the pod race. Mm. And the same thing, I think, happens with the Quidditch. I just don't get the sense that anything else is happening other than, "Wee! Quidditch!" It doesn't teach me anything about Harry. It doesn't teach me anything about Weird Teeth Kid. It doesn't teach me anything about what's happening. It's just, "Wee!" And I don't know. It just doesn't do anything for me. And it's not shot particularly well. It's kind of all over the place. There's no geography. And maybe that's by design.
It's a flying, zippy sport.
Maybe. It also feels like to me, well, I don't know. We'll get into it. And the great for me, though, the great is absolutely Harry the first night of him being at Hogwarts.
Yes.
The first night of him being at Hogwarts. And that is him sitting on the windowsill. Everybody is asleep. Everybody is... Harry is alone, and he's just sitting in the windowsill, staring up at the moon with Hedwig right there. And it's one of the few moments in the film, kind of like Ollivander's, where it just stays put.
Yep.
And it doesn't show you anything. I mean, it doesn't tell you anything. It's not in your face. It's not, "Look at Hogwarts. Look how cute it is. Look how fun this is." None of that. It just
allows you to sit.
It's just a little boy sitting in his windowsill, smiling. And once that happens, the movie goes into full gear for me, because now you understand the loneliness and also the family that comes to beat back that loneliness. Mm-hmm. I think that's just wonderful.
I agree.
That is excellent. So where do you want to attack this film, Marvin? How do you want to go for it?
I just need to give, like, you know, those Hall of Fame winners that just win so often that they're like, they can't win anymore, but you just need to acknowledge them.
Yes.
We need to acknowledge John Williams.
Yes.
His score. Because I feel like we could say that for greats for all of these films.
That's true.
We'll of course go into it a bit more, but just need to give it up for our boy, John.
Yeah, no, of course, it's John Williams. I mean, when you have that kind of composer, you know, the funny thing is that James Horner was supposed to be the original composer of Harry Potter, but he couldn't do it. So he's like, "Hey, John, come on."
Yeah.
James Horner, of course, is the guy who did music to, like, Braveheart and
Finding Nemo, right?
He did Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
And then he's also done a whole bunch of other films.
I like that's the one I remember him from, mostly.
I know. I think he also did Titanic, too.
I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah, that was him. He did Titanic. Yeah. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of films that are out there for James Horner. You can go and listen to him.
Finding Nemo. Did I say Finding Nemo or Finding Dory?
You said Finding Nemo.
Okay, good. Yes.
But John Williams came in and does it. Do you find his... Here's the one thing I will say against the score of for John Williams.
You watch your mouth.
Well, I know. I'm just going
to
say this.
I may need to wash it out with soap.
I'm just going
to
say this. Go back and watch Hook, because John Williams did the score for Hook as well.
Yes, he did.
It's a little derivative of Hook.
It's a little derivative of all John Williams soundtracks.
So many French horns. All the French horns.
No joke. You can sit down. If you find a movie that you're like, I don't know the soundtrack that well. Superman, for example.
Yes.
You listen to some of the more obscure songs, not just like din, 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 like not the main score, but you listen to some other bits of it and you're like, this sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
He uses his own stuff a lot.
That's true.
Can you blame him?
Have you ever played the
It's good.
Have you ever played the John Williams Challenge?
No.
Oh, you've ever played the John Williams Challenge?
What does this even mean?
You have to hump, you have to do what you just did with Superman.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do Superman.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana Jones and Star Wars all in a row.
All in a row?
All in a row. And no, but not like you have to do the main hymn of it.
Okay.
Da, 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 da. Okay, now do Indiana Jones.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you have to do. Dun. Dun, 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 dun. You have to do that.
Oh, I was doing the intro.
Yeah.
In case you don't. I'm singing the Barry Sax line.
Ah! And then you have to do the Star Wars one. And the reason why that they had the John Williams challenge is because they're so similar that people screw them up and they forget, like, their brain shit stops. And they're like, oh, whoa, wait, hold on, what? And so it's Superman, Indiana Jones, and Star Wars.
Can you all do it?
So that's
so a question. So try it again. So it's...
No, I'm going to let you do it because you're the music. You're the music.
And then... Dun 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 without the intro. Dun 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 dun. What's the next song?
Star Wars.
Oh, which one would you like?
The main theme.
Which is the main theme?
The one that plays over the credits.
The Force?
No, the one that plays over the credits.
Which one's that one?
You're killing time.
I'm not killing time.
You're killing time. You're trying to think of it, aren't you?
I'm trying to go through the index of which one it is. Is it the Force theme?
The one that plays over the credits. The Star Wars. Duh! You know?
No, I don't know. I play it in the score and they all have titles.
That one.
Okay.
You're supposed to do all in a row. You see, you killed too much time.
All right. They all have names.
Oh, man. Okay, now we got to move on from the John Williams challenge. People are like,
okay.
Oh my God, guys, get over it.
All right, the analysis of this movie.
All right, so yeah, what do you think? How do you want to do this? Because, you know, the funny thing is that actually Steven Spielberg was originally contacted to direct this film. It was supposed to be Steven Spielberg. And he couldn't do it. J.K. Rowling, I'm sorry, the author, wanted Terry Gilliam to direct this film. Couldn't do it. So then they ended up with Chris Columbus. What did you think about Chris Columbus's job here? Let's put casting aside. Let's put the kid actors aside.
That's all thanks to him.
Yes. And the casting director. But
yeah.
And also the author producer. Because she handpicked most of these people. Not the kids, but like the older actors.
Yeah.
She handpicked them. How it's shot, the way that the pacing is, did you feel like it lagged? Did you feel like, most importantly, Mary, here's the real question. Do you feel like it caught the essence of the book?
100%. Yes.
In what way?
Okay. But mind you, I'm a super fan.
Yes.
So it's hard for me to look at this movie through really, really critical eyes as I longed for this movie for years. Mm-hmm. I longed for it. And when the first songs of the first little Hedwig's theme came out, and then when the first trailer came out and all of this excitement, you know, it's hard to distinguish the director from the actors because it was really thanks to him that they were able to do what they did in Shine. I think that Chris Columbus was chosen in because he's a phenomenal director with children. He's really, really great with them. He's very patient with them. And as someone who is a middle school drama teacher, you need patience. I always would tell people, they're like, how do you teach middle school? I'm like, you need to have humor and patience. Those are the two main things you need when you're working with, you know, fifth graders through eighth graders, which is really what Chris Columbus did. And I think that you can see that the kids were able to have fun. They were able to have that flexibility because he had to be their teacher.
Sure.
It wasn't just, here's your gig, which it was for the regular, you know, for the adult actors.
Yep.
He had to teach them. And I think that it takes a special person. I know that Steven Spielberg has experience with kids. But I think that Chris Columbus made this very special and childlike.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this movie was made for children. You know, the other ones do get a bit darker and just, you know, more adult friendly, but this really made you feel like a kid, and I appreciate that.
Do you feel like they caught because I'm wearing my Stats Are for Nerds shirt.
Yes.
For a reason, okay? For those of you who are watching on the live, you know, here it is. That's Mary, sorry.
Hi.
That's me. Stats Are for Nerds. Because...
I love that you like stand up and hold it.
Well, I have to because of the way that things are.
Well, hopefully our audio podcast listeners get a good feel of this.
So go to maryandblake.com, check out the shop button. You'll see the Stats Are for Nerds shirt while you're at the Mary and Blake store. And I say Stats Are for Nerds because a lot of people, especially in the Outlander fandom, they look at all these little details and they're like, oh, this little detail wasn't in there and I hated it because it does this and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, the most famous one, as I've said before, is Claire in Outlander is trying to make mold for penicillin. And they're like,
I thought you were going to say the wolf.
Oh, the wolf. Yeah, yeah. The wolf is another one that I hate. But Claire's trying to make mold for penicillin, yeah. And it's in the 1700s. And they're like, you can't put bread under glass. It won't get mold quick enough. It's like, come on, dude. What do we care? Stats are for nerds. You get the idea. She's trying to make mold. What does it matter if it's under glass or not? Who cares?
Okay, so your point with Harry Potter.
My point with Harry Potter is this. I don't want to do the whole tit for tat, like, oh, this was in the book, that wasn't in the book.
Agreed.
Because I don't think it's important. Stats are for nerds. What do we care as long as what was in the book, the thematic through line of it,
yes.
And what they tried to achieve is in the film.
So a big example of this is the lack of the Midnight Duel and also the rescue of Norbert. Mm-hmm. You know, those are two major things in the book that are not in the movie.
Right.
And what Blake and I were noticing during last night's rewatch is that where the Midnight Duel would have happened in the movie would have been right after Malfoy took the Marimbral and flew off on the broom and, you know, had this taunting thing with Harry. So we already had a pretty remarkable interaction between these two, you know, pretty, you got to see they were opposing. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't need another reason to not like Malfoy. We already don't like Malfoy due to his previous behavior. And then when it came to Norbert, they were able to kind of quicken things up without it being multiple trips to Hagrid's hut. They were just able to have Draco spying on the trio, mm-hmm. as Norbert hatches.
Yep.
And from there, they're able to wrap things up. So I think the movie did actually an extraordinary job of tying up those two plot points, mm-hmm. and just kind of getting rid of them for the sake of time.
Yep, everyone in the comments section is saying, especially Angela, oh my God, let go of the mold, Blake. Let go. No, I refuse. For those of you who listen to Outlander Cast, go to maryandblake.com, check out the episodes of Outlander.
Or don't.
And I went on a big diatribe about this whole mold thing. No, I refuse to let it go because it was so
Blake,
dorky.
We're done.
Okay. the only thing I will say about it, about the stats for nerds of it all, is this. The ending, to me, of the film, I think, is changed in a way that takes away from the theme of what they were trying to accomplish.
Elaborate.
And this is why I bring it up, because I think all the other changes, for the most part, are good changes. They compress the whole story, and you got to get this book into 2.5 hours. And not only do you have to get the book done in 2.5 hours, you have to introduce this entire world. It's not like you're in movie 4 and you just accept things as they are, because we've already been through it.
Yeah, you don't need an introduction.
It's kind of like the MCU. If they introduced everything in the MCU for every single film, you would sit there for 4 hours, mm-hmm. 5 hours, because that world is part of itself. It's a living entity. And the same thing goes for Harry Potter. In this film, they try to introduce the entire world. There's only so much time that you have, so they have to get to the most important things. Having said that, I think an important thing in the end of the book is that Harry is rescued. It's not Harry just touches the guy and the guy croaks.
Quirrell,
yes, he does die, but it's not necessarily 100% because of Harry. It's not that Harry touched him and then all of a sudden he turned into stone or ash like he does in the film, and that's that. And the thing that we've talked about in the film, I mean, in the book series here so far, a lot, is the ending of the book lends credence to the idea that it's not just Harry. It's not just the chosen one who is able to take on the darkest wizard of all time. He needs help. Yes, he does get help from Ron and Hermione, but he needs help in the end because he's an 11-year-old. And it shows those two stories going together as one. The one of Harry Potter, wee, Hogwarts! And then, ooh.
This stuff is real.
This is bad news.
Yeah. I mean,
like, this is like a legit story that has evil stuff in it, and this kid is in way over his head, and he needs help. So because of that, when Harry just offs Quirrell the way that he does, and then he kind of passes out because Voldemort's soul flies through him, It's like that takes away from the power of the ending in the book. And I want to get your thoughts on that.
Why do you think they made this change? Because I think they could have simply still had like Harry and Quirrell in kind of a blurry, phased out interaction with, you know, Dumbledore hazily pulling Quirrell off of him. You know, why do you think it ended this way? Do you think they needed us to visually see Quirrell die and Voldemort vanish? Do we need to see that so we could believe it?
That's a good question. And the other thing about the book is that as a writer, you know, you can write as much dialogue as you want for the most part. And you can go back and forth. There's no such thing as real pacing. I mean, there is pacing in a book, but not like in a film, you know. And the beautiful thing about film is that you can do things that a book can't. Mm-hmm. For example, Harry sitting on the ledge in Hogwarts right for his first night. Yes. You can't do that in the book.
No.
But you can do that in film.
You can't give it in the book, but it's a little
different. It's different. Yeah. It's much different. It's show, not tell. In the book, there's a lot of expository dialogue about Voldemort between Harry and Dumbledore. Mm-hmm. And is he gone? Is he not gone? Da, 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 da. Like, what about this? And what about that? And in a film, if you did that, it'd be kind of like the architect scene in The Matrix Reloaded, where the whole movie just comes to a blinding, like, screeching halt just so these two characters can talk about what just happened in this entire film.
Yeah.
I feel like if they did that with Dumbledore at the end of this film, you'd be like, what are we doing, dude?
Yes.
And because of that, and also I think they kind of lacked a little guts. I think they wanted to make a safe movie.
It was for kids, Blake.
No. What I mean is they wanted to make a safe movie and they didn't want kids or even adults who are watching the film to not see Harry come through by himself.
Yeah.
They wanted him to go there and beat the bad guy. Mm-hmm. He is the chosen one.
Yeah.
Let's see him beat the bad guy. Let's not do the, oh, he kind of does it, but he really gets his butt rescued.
See, I see it as it is final and you don't have questions. That if they didn't get to make more of these movies, that, you know, Quirrell was dead. All is well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it was even Quirrell's fault. I'm fine with that ending. It is a little weird. But I'm fine with that. I think because you're already so accustomed to so much other magical stuff throughout the movie that this doesn't faze you too awfully much. It is spooky and it is jarring. I think that, you know, when you're watching it with a youngster and there is so much merriment to this movie and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're in the Forbidden Forest and something is drinking unicorn blood.
Yeah,
like,
and you see the teeth.
Yeah,
and
maybe we're not going to let little kids watch this right now. Right. It's, you know, that's when things start to shift. I think, of course, that these movies are designed to be seen by children whose ages they are. Like, that's when you know they're really in the clear. Obviously, people show it to people of all ages.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue that the movie really struggles with, Mary, because the film is two separate stories. It's the wee Hogwarts, and then all of a sudden, it's Voldemort and unicorn blood.
I mean, it starts off. The movie starts off with some guy trying to kill a baby.
Well, no, I mean, it doesn't start that way. It starts with...
is it true?
Yeah.
Are they dead?
That? Yeah, that's true.
And
that's
the boy?
Yeah. So, I would... I would say that it almost kind of like the movie struggles with the two stories at the end. Like there's even time, and I can understand why they didn't do it, but not spending a lot of time in the Forbidden Forest. Like I feel like that's also kind of something that I think thematically for the book, it's part of those two stories.
You're being really negative.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying those are the two things that I think.
Well, let's talk
important.
About the awesome stuff then.
Okay, fine, fair enough.
Well, I know what's going to light you up, like the 4th of July.
Okay.
Alan Rickman.
Oh, yes! Oh, yes. You know what? It's a preemptive. Makes me wanna shout. Alan Rickman makes me want to shout. That man is perfect. And it's that it's perfect timing right there. He is in every buttery, velvety, soft word that just drips out of his mouth to the breaking.
New celebrity.
Clearly, fame isn't everything.
You know, as we watched it last night, we love the scene of. I mean, should we just like start from the beginning and like kind of run through about what we love?
Yeah, whatever you want. Let's do it.
Okay, so we start off with baby Harry Potter and Dumbledore.
Yep.
Coming on in. We get to see the Deluminator, which, you know, we remarked upon it last night. For those of you who are at jointhenerdclan.com, you're able to hear it. But like the Deluminator, I always have a problem with that in the Remembrall, especially in this movie, because they're two of my least favorite magical objects. I just don't really see the purpose in them that much. I know it comes into play later, but I just don't love it. And then we get to just see these really magical people, but we get to hear John Williams' music, and it just opens things up
right
in such a eerie way. And yet Richard Harris is so tender and sweet when you see him just walking along that you're like, oh, this isn't bad.
Right.
Yeah, they're witches and wizards, but like, whatever.
It's fine. And that's, again, one of the brilliant things that the film does is that it just gets right to the point. It you get right in it. And that is... Okay, here we're in Privet Drive. We're in this world, and you can tell that things are a little off. Even though we're in the Muggle world, even though things are happening that would apparently just be normal, it's very foggy. Even like the lens that they use is very soft, so that everything is kind of hazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's by design.
Yeah,
it's designed to be mysterious and full of questioning. And it's even dark. It's very dark the way that they open up the film.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting.
Yes. And again, I like the fact that they go from that and they have Harry as a baby. They put the letter down there and everything. And all of a sudden, they just get to the point. There's no like Mr. Dursley, Vernon, like walking around and listening to
checking
people.
Checking out drills.
There's no drills. There's no bumping into wizards. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. It's just... We're in the world, and now all of a sudden we get to the cartoonish, if you will, Dursleys who and Dudley banging on the stairs,
yes.
And you get an immediate sense that Harry is really alone and he's bullied. Would you agree?
Oh, completely. I mean, you see it from, you know, exactly Petunia waking him up and actually unlocking him out of his little cupboard under the stairs, and hurry up, boy, hurry up, says Uncle Vernon.
And he plays with the little figurines.
And he does that, of course, later as he's about to leave Privet Drive.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So many little throwbacks. And, of course, you know, we get to see Dudley, and he's just this greedy little bugger who wants more presents. And this is when we get to see Harry's letter arrive.
Right, right. I like this, too. I like the fact that it was very efficient. The whole thing with the Dursleys was efficient. You know, within the first 6, 7, 8 minutes or so, they're already at the... They're already at the zoo, and shortly after that, they're getting all the letters.
Yep.
And shortly after that, they're at the cottage,
and there comes
in the ocean, and here's Hagrid, and boom, that's that. The one thing I will say about the film that I think is a little bit of a detraction from the overall story is the fact that they go from Harry being at the cottage to all of a sudden Hagrid takes him, and then he ends up at school. Like, I missed the part in the book where it was Harry had to go back to the Dursleys.
It would have just taken too much time.
It absolutely would have. And I understand why they cut it, because you can't, again, that would be the whole, you know, screeching halt aspect of it all.
I like it that they've been trying to give him this letter. Like, you don't know how much time has gone by in the movie where they've been attempting, and Hagrid finally has to go get this kid because school starts in 2 days.
Right.
So he has to hurry up and get him and get his stuff. Or does he start in 1 day? You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like, okay, this is the last moment. We haven't gotten Harry's letter back. Let's, you know, Hagrid go pick him up on the way.
Sure.
So he goes and gets him, and this is where you get your first sight of Fogrid.
Yeah, oh, Fogrid. So there's Fogrid, and then there's Hagrid. Hagrid played by Robbie Coltrane, and Fogrid played by some dude. I don't know.
Forget his name.
I don't remember
it's
his
like
name.
Like Marvin
either.
Or something.
Sure. Marvin, whatever. Stats are for nerds. And there is a distinct difference between Fogrid and
Fogrid
Hagrid.
So Fogrid is the actor who plays Fogrid, the fake Hagrid, is a giant of a man. He's just a really, really big actor. And in actuality, they created like this face, this mechanical face mask to look like Robbie Coltrane's Hagrid. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so he was bundled up, you know, he's just a big guy anyway, and they've got him with all these pads and this giant costume and the wig and this mechanical face mask thing to express slightly what Hagrid would be expressing. But in any of the scenes where it is a normal-sized human with the giant-sized Hagrid, it's actually a different actor. And if you look at his face, it does look a little weird.
It looks nothing like a real human.
And they keep the Fogrid for how many movies?
I think it's the first two films with Chris Columbus.
And then they figure out with CGI or other things. And they try different things with camera angles to make the actor of Hagrid, Robbie Coltrane, look bigger.
In depth of camera.
They'll have him more zoomed in and the camera will be from below him. So he looks bigger. He looks like he is above the other characters.
Yep.
And, you know, even in the cottage, like, he takes up the majority of the screen when it comes to the camera shot. And then when it goes to the Dursley family, Mr. and Mrs. Dursley, they're zoomed out a bit more. And they don't take up as much of the frame to make them seem smaller in comparison. Like, it tells your brain, this is a very big guy.
Yeah, this is a big guy. And a lot of the shots with Robbie Coltrane, it's just him singly in the frame.
Yes.
And that's it. For the most part, you see very little actual interaction between Robbie Coltrane and Daniel Radcliffe or one of the big three. In the same frame.
Yeah. Whenever
you see a lot of cuts.
Yes. So if they're walking down Diagon Alley, it's Fogrid. If he's like handing him something and it's like this massive hand, it's Fogrid.
Yeah.
They do Hagrid shots generally as like a single shot.
Correct.
To make sure that it looks like him. But still, I'm pretty sure he acted the scenes and then Fogrid would like follow in behind and act it. But Daniel Radcliffe had to do all those scenes pretty much twice. You know, with different Hagrids.
Sure, yeah. More than that, probably. I bet you had to do each scene five times.
40, 50.
For coverage and for getting Fogrid in, getting Harry's reactions in, getting Robbie Coltrane's actions in. Like, all of it all together, I bet you each scene was done at least five times.
I think that something that was done really well in this movie was how Hagrid had to tell Harry everything. You know, he had to tell him, like, your parents were killed and he was mad at the Dursleys and this is how this all goes. And he, of course, takes him onto Diagon Alley. So this is where we get to see one of my favorite scenes. We get to go to Diagon Alley and see all the shops and see the Nimbus 2000. We get to be at Ollivander's and the magic that we were talking about. While we're also there, though, we get to go to Gringotts. And I think Gringotts itself was quite the marvel.
Yeah, it's absolutely an epic, and I don't mean epic like the way the kids say it today. I mean literally epic design.
Epic.
Oh my God, it's epic, guy. It is a marvel in how they did Gringotts with all of the flooring and the goblins themselves, the fine detail with all the little weights and measures and in that big chandelier with the cobwebs and even the uneven columns with the, you know, and how it says Gring, like, and I know that portion of it is CGI itself, and that's fine. But just the interior design of it all, the feel of it, how silent it was.
Yes.
There's no score being played in Gringotts. You know, like, you feel like you are in an institution when you're there. You know, like, and not an institution like I'm crazy, but like an institution that has been there forever.
You know, and something that's interesting, we messed up a tad bit last night on our commentary track, but we get to meet one of the goblins when they go up and Hagrid says, you know, I'm here for Harry Potter and also a little something from Dumbledore. Here's my top secret letter. Mm-hmm. And the first goblin that we interact with is played by the actor Warwick Davis, who also plays Professor Flitwick. And then a different goblin takes Hagrid and Harry. His name is Griphook, and he takes them to Harry's vault where he gets his money. And then, of course, to Vault 713. Thank you. I was going to say 712, and I'm like, that is not it.
Anyway.
713. And what's interesting is Warwick Davis voiced.
Stand back.
He voiced that Griphook.
Yes.
So even though he wasn't the actor who portrayed Griphook in movie one was the same actor who was Mini-Me in Austin Powers.
Verne Troyer.
Yeah. But when Griphook comes back in latter books, at the last book,
Last film.
It is Warwick Davis who portrays Griphook.
Yes.
Both, both.
So Mary and I had a little bit of an argument.
Yeah, we were like, who is that? Is that Warwick Davis? Is that not Warwick Davis? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's this. Oh, is Grip Hook the one that is important? Yes, yes it is. So, yeah, so it was really neat to see that. We've actually were able to interview one of the prosthetics people who made like all the goblin masks. Yep. We interviewed him for the Outlander Cast podcast, but he was saying how incredible that experience was to make all these different masks for these people as well, these actors. So we spend that time at Gringotts. We learn the important things. And then, of course, we go to King's Cross Station, which...
I got to ask your opinion on this.
Okay.
Hagrid's there, and he says, stick to your ticket, and then
poof,
takes off.
I wonder, does he operate? Do you have any questions?
There's no logical way to get Hagrid from...
Standing next to Harry
at Diagon Alley, and then all of a sudden for him to go to King's Cross, but then also have Harry be alone so that he can ask the Weasleys, hey, how do I do this? So there's no logical way to make it happen. So they just do the Houdini and they say, oh, Hagrid's gone. Like, stick to your ticket, Harry. And that's What do you think about it? Because it's a little frustrating.
I know.
It's a little frustrating.
Listen, I love me some Hagrid, but that was definitely a faux pas on his part. He was just getting a little nervous. He probably, he looked at the time.
Yeah.
Hagrid needs to get an Apple Watch that reminds him, like, hey, in 15 minutes, you should probably leave. And then, of course, we have the worst train helper whatsoever. We have this little boy come up to him.
Think you're being funny, do you?
Yeah, and he's even worse in the movie than in the book. Like, Harry is this little boy walking around with all these packages and everything asking for help.
Excuse me.
Think you're being funny, do you? Once again, just walks off.
Go back and listen to it. The guy who acts it and says it, he doesn't say think. He says think.
Think you're being funny, do you?
Think you're being funny, do you? It, like, every time I hear it, it's all I can think of.
We get to meet the Weasley family, who are so perfectly cast.
Yes, yes.
And we get to see Platform 9 3/4, which you and I both said was so much better done than the bricks at Diagon Alley.
Oh, yeah. Much better. Much better. Oh, well, Mary, we are at 52 minutes already for this podcast. So if we want to hurry through, not hurry, but how long do you want this episode to be? Let's ask that question.
Let's stand out moments. Ready?
Okay.
What's your standout moment from the children going to Hogwarts?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think my standout moment is Hermione just pointing some wand at a kid who has no idea what a wand does.
For example.
And she's just like, Oculus Reparo! And Harry's face is just like, what are you doing, dude?
The last time he saw a wand be pointed, his cousin got a pigtail.
I know. So like, okay, you're going to do this to me? Like, fine. I always find that little interaction hysterical.
I love the boats pulling up to Hogwarts. I think that's quite wonderful. How about for the Sorting Hat Ceremony? What caught you the most?
The Sorting Hat Ceremony... I think what catches my eye most is the uniqueness of the hat design, how it uses its folds to speak, and the fact that is in the book, it doesn't necessarily say that the hat speaks aloud. I get the sense that it's in Harry's head, that the way that the hat speaks.
That's how I feel it too.
And the fact that they had to translate that to film and they have the hat speak with the folds and how it's all beaten up and everything, I find that excellent. And I also like the circling of Harry. I'm not a huge fan of how Chris Columbus directs this film, like with his shots. Like, there's nothing unique about what he does.
I mean, it was 2001.
I agree. There's nothing unique about how he captures the film. Like, everything is center framed for the most part, and there is that one unique shot at Diagon Alley with the Nimbus 2000.
Yeah.
Starts off with the kids. Oh my God, it's the Nimbus 2000, and then the focus comes back onto the broom, and then the focus goes onto Harry as he's walking past it, and then the final shot. It's all one shot. The final little focus is the focus coming off of Harry back onto the Nimbus 2000 to focus on the logo.
Yes.
I find that excellent. And that's good foreshadowing for what's about to happen.
Agreed.
But other than that, Columbus doesn't really do a whole ton to help himself with the film in the way that it's shot.
He's such a negative Nancy right now.
However, in the sorting hat ceremony, he does this really cool thing where he circles Harry and he allows it to just see the back of Harry's head.
Yep.
Which is not something that you would think that would happen. And because of that, I like that little bit of directing. How about you? What stands out for you?
You know, that the moment when Harry locks eye contact with Snape and really we're seeing the back of Quirrell's head, you mentioned it in our commentary podcast, how Quirrell really is always in the shots when Harry is in pain or when things are going wrong. Like, he is always there.
Yes.
So when you do rewatch it, you're like, oh yeah, he was there. He was always in the room, you know? So it does, it's fun to go back and see, but I agree with you. That shot is pretty cool. We get to, of course, see the kids learn how to take a go on the broomsticks. We meet Fluffy the dog. Then, of course, they figure out the Sorcerer's Stone and everything.
What'd you think about Fluffy, the CGI with Fluffy?
I thought it was okay for the day and age. For 2001?
I would agree. For what it was, it was pretty good.
You know what I really did enjoy was the invisibility cloak. I think the patterning of the fabric with the invisibility cloak was really cool and
pretty.
Felt
old.
Yeah, I liked how they would shoot it from underneath with Harry so you could kind of see through to see the pattern, to see what it would be like for his sight as he's, you know, going around the school looking for these books. It was fun to see as he, you know, became invisible with it on. So I really enjoyed that. And then, let's see, just Christmas and Halloween. I think all the times that we have in the Great Hall are very magical and fun. And I think, especially as a rewatch, I think it's always fun to see how the Great Hall is decorated, to see
all
the food that comes
real
out.
Real food, by the way. All real food.
Oh, you could tell those kids that were just gluttonous while they were doing it.
Right.
I loved all the adult actors. The adult actors are just so precious and fantastic at their craft.
That casting for all of the adult actors, I mean, that is one of those things where you're like, whoa, these people, like you, and they all have relatively small roles. Like Alan Rickman shows up for three, 4, 5 minutes of the film, and that's about it.
We do not see him on a broomstick.
No, you do not. And Maggie Smith, same thing. She's there for like 5 minutes of the film. And that's it. But what they do is they lend a gravitas to the film. They lend a certain authority to the film where you're watching them and you're like, okay, these people, like, I get it. Like, Alan Rickman is Die Hard. It's Hans Gruber. And I cannot picture a better person being Snape than Alan Rickman. His hand, that moment when he introduces himself to Harry, and it's like that hand movement that he has.
Yes.
And like, you can sense the palpable tension and the hatred, like, you know, when that hand movement, like, you only do that when you really hate something.
Agreed.
And like, oh my God, you know, like, oh man, that was excellent stuff.
You know, obviously, it's been so long since these movies have come out that before, when I had read the books, you know, I did picture Severus Snape being a little bit different than how Alan Rickman is, a little bit more sharp-edged, a little bit more long and oilier hair, for example. But these people, all of the cast, have really done it for me. They've just that's who I frequently see.
Sure.
I think that I agree with you. I think they hit it out of the ballpark. It makes you wonder, like, did they really know how big this was going to be? You know, it's hard for me because I feel like in the beginning I enjoyed Potter pretty much by myself. You know, nobody I knew was really reading the books along with me. And
yeah, it's funny. They spent about $130 million on this film, which at the time was pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, you're having films that are usually made in the 50 to 60 range at that point. You know, every once in a while, you know, you'd get an Armageddon that was, you know, huge money, or Independence Day, huge money. And for the most part, 125 at the time, even now, at the time it was big.
Yeah.
Even now, it's still pretty big.
Yeah.
They put a lot of money into it. And at that point, you know, the books came out in, 97? By this point, the movie was coming out in 2001, so it had been around for about 4 years.
Yeah.
There had already been four books. They had already taken the world by storm in terms of 200, 300 million copies sold or whatever it was. There's a lot of pressure here.
Yeah.
Do you kind of get the sense that they understood that there was pressure?
I do, because of this casting. I do because they knew, okay, we need some big names behind it. And the big names said yes. You know, this wasn't, oh yeah, this is just some fun little kids movie. Like, this was you know, this is a multi-series. This is catching the world by storm. This is reinvigorated. Because remember, this is what was so important about the Harry Potter series. It got people excited to read. It got youngsters excited to read. It got people who hadn't picked up a book for fun in a long time, myself included. You know, I was in the end of high school. I feel like I spent almost all my time reading books for school. I barely had any time to myself between sports and band and my AP classes. And in the summers, I mean, I would read, but I kind of just wanted to veg out. And then here came Potter. And I was like, I couldn't get enough. And I feel like that is what captivated the world at first.
Sure.
So a lot of this cast had read the books, so, and I think they knew.
We all know that this film is the beginning of a much larger franchise. This is something that, you know, Warner Brothers invested its time into. Again, $125, $130 million just in this film alone. Not even counting the advertising aspect of all. Largely, the advertising budget in these kinds of tentpole films equal the amount of money that they spend on actually making the film, if not a little bit less. So you can pretty much assume that they spent 250 million big ones on this bad boy. You know, what makes this film, as it begins this franchise, different from any of the other YA franchises? What makes this film stand out, do you think, in comparison to other young adult franchises that have failed, whether it is Ender's Game or Divergent or Percy Jackson, like, you know, Chris Columbus, they probably thought, oh man, we got the guy who started Harry Potter. Let's make him Percy Jackson. What makes you think that this stands out from the rest?
You know what's weird? Because I've watched a lot of those, and when I watched a lot of those movies, I feel like they're trying too hard.
You know what movie tried really too hard? Aragorn.
You know what I was going to say? What? Was the Dark Elements. Wasn't that the one with Nicole Kidman and like the polar bear and the girl that had all the little like
fun tools? Yes, that his Dark Elements is the HBO version of it, but that was
The Compass, the Golden Compass.
The Golden Compass. Yeah.
And mind you, I've read all of these books and I thoroughly enjoyed them as a series, and
Dark Materials, Materials, sorry.
I just feel like even though this was grand and it was a whole world building experience and it was full of wonder, it felt very real. And I don't know if that's because we went, I think a lot of it is because we went on the journey with Harry. And you do that with a lot of these other characters in these movies. You go on the journey with them. But I think the acting by this cast throughout it. I think the fault with some of those movies is they'll have like one or two standout actors who are really good. But then the surrounding ones, the Filches or the, you know, the Hagrids or whatever, the surrounding, not Dumbledores, aren't great. And so you might have one or two, you might have a Nicole Kidman, you might have, you know, a named person. But I think this cast was so stellar that they all raised the bar with each other. And because of that, they raised the children's bar of acting. I just think that this was it felt much more natural. It felt like it gave me those times to breathe, like the Hedwig moment, like the moment with the hat, whereas the other ones, as I said, I just feel like they're trying too hard, and that might be because of the supporting cast acting.
You know, I wonder if, you know, since because the books were such a phenomenon, there's a real chance that the films just don't cut it. Like, there's a real chance they mess up the film. And I think they made a film that was, it treated the books with such respect, like it almost to a fault. It was, and that's why I say the film felt almost episodic, because I felt like they were taking all the greatest hits of what the book was trying to do. And they're like, okay, let's do the Remember All. Okay, now it's time to do Fluffy. It's time to do Norbert.
But you had to for the plot points.
I agree. And that's the thing. I think people love the books. So they, and Jake and the author is on set, like hounding over everybody, making sure that her book is translated properly. I think because it did such a unique and direct adaptation of the book that people appreciated it for what it was, and the films themselves grew into themselves. But I think this particular film, it just happened to catch at the right moment, at the right time, with the right people.
Yeah,
I think it just happened to have that that wonder. I mean, shortly after the release of the film, I think was, I think it was after 9/11, right? Or was it before 9/11?
I don't know. Good question.
But I mean, regardless, whatever it is, it still allowed that film. That film allowed a sense of escape.
Yeah, from November 4th.
Yeah. So that film allowed for a sense of escape for all of this.
Or 16th for the U.S., yeah.
And I think people went to Harry looking for just a reason to get away from it all.
Because you're right. You know, that's the thing. People, they say that a lot of kids who grew up watching these movies, they kind of saw Voldemort as, you know, like this terrorist.
Sure, yeah. Bin Laden-esque.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because it happened right within that same time frame.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
Right. You had a couple of trivia.
Yeah. Let's do some trivia. So a couple of facts of trivia. I always like to do this for these kind of films because, you know, everybody knows these films so well and everybody watches them all the time. I like trivia about this. Alan Rickman was handpicked to play Snape by the author and was given special instructions from her about his character. Mm-hmm. And the author even provided them with vital details of Snape's backstory, i.e. what happens with Lily and everything,
yep,
in advance. Nobody else knew. And like, for example, she had to write the interaction between Voldemort and Lily. Steve Kloves did not write that because only she knew what was actually happening at that time.
Wow.
So there is a little bit of
very
fun trivia. Warner Brothers actually wanted to make Harry Potter a set of animated films originally.
Yeah.
Because they didn't feel like they could get all the actors to be on the same age length between how like the films were being made. Mm-hmm. So they had to make a decision. And the author said, no, you need to make this a real film.
Wow.
And you need to have all the same actors.
Yep.
Because if you miscast or you change the cast, it ain't going to feel like how this is supposed to feel. So they had to make a decision well in advance of this film. Actually, they didn't necessarily know how well it was going to do, even though it was pretty much guaranteed it was going to make a boatload of money. But they had to make a decision and saying, we're going to film all these films back to back. We're just going
to
do it.
We just have to.
We'd have to in order to keep the age
and
process
children,
right.
Your childhood will be at Leaves and Studios.
And not only that, they were even considering condensing books into one film. So like books 1 and 2 would be one film.
Can you imagine?
No,
I mean, there's already
cannot.
So much out there being like, please make this a TV show because we needed it longer.
The author was revealed on her website that she was offered to play the role of Lily Potter.
Oh.
And she turned it down.
Good.
Because she didn't feel like it was appropriate.
Agreed.
They tried to give Harry or Daniel Radcliffe green contacts to match the mother's eyes.
In the book, they're described as green. Yeah.
He tried them on for one day, had almost an allergic reaction to them, and the author had to approve the fact that Harry had blue eyes.
With said approval saying it needs to still match the actress who plays the mother's eyes.
Right.
And in latter movies, we get to see young version of Lily, and she has brown eyes.
Right. And also, they tried to give Emma Watson buck teeth, and she couldn't speak properly with the buck teeth. So they had to remove them by the beginning of the film. The floating candles in the Great Hall were originally real candles. They were hanging suspended with fish wire. But then somebody... one of the candles burned inappropriately and the candle wax fell and it hurt somebody, I guess, or something along those lines. And they deemed it too dangerous
for
all the kids that were underneath all these candles. So they had to go in and digitally replace in the scenes that they shot all of the candles. And then they did digital creations for all the candles.
You know, because you were even saying that last night while we were watching it. You were like, oh, I think these are real candles. And I was like, what about all that hot wax above all these kids? Like, that's just not safe. So I'm glad that it was digital.
The cat that was used to...
Mrs. Norris?
Play Mrs. Norris ran away.
No.
Ran away from the set. And she was gone for like 2 or 3 days. They couldn't find her.
She was like, this is an amazing castle. Yeah. There are so many mice here.
Ran away.
Trevor, man. Have you seen my toad?
In the trophy cupboard to the right of the Quidditch trophy, you can see the service to the school trophy with the name Tom M. Riddle.
Stop it.
Tom M. Riddle engraved on it.
Why would that still be there?
I don't know. And not same thing, next to Harry's father's name in the inscription for the Seeker is actually one M. McGonagall.
What? Wait.
That saying that she was a chaser. Oh, I'm sorry, that she was a seeker.
On that, okay, I have to look at that trophy. Again. Wow.
It says M. McGonagall. And also, another name says R.J.H. King. That was in reference to John King, who was the supervising art director on the film.
Very cute.
Here's a really fun one. After Steven Spielberg dropped out of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, who was his first recommendation to direct?
I don't know who.
M. Night Shyamalan.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember, this is right before The Sixth Sense.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
It's right before The Sixth Sense.
Okay. So before his really big breakthrough.
M. Night Shyamalan was recommended by Steven Spielberg, but he turned it down to make The Sixth Sense. And then they brought in Chris Columbus afterwards.
I can't see M. Night Shyamalan doing this.
I know. It'd be weird.
And then it was Quirrell.
I know.
I mean, it would work.
Actually, I think it kind of would work, to be honest.
You know who the other person I would have thought would have been great for this? Danny Elfman. I mean, not Danny Elfman. He's the composer.
Tim Burton. Tim Burton would have been kind of weird.
Yeah, he would have made Hogwarts like so.
He would have gotten weird with it, and I think it kind of would have been cool if he got weird with it.
He would have been like the Dumbledore weird.
Let's see.
You know what I mean? Like, think of Dumbledore's speech in the first day.
Yeah, he definitely would have put the Hoggy Hogwarts song in
there. He would have loved that.
He would have been all about that life.
Tim Burton would have been all over it.
Let's see. Hermione says to Harry that he is a great wizard. In fact, Harry, at no point in this film, actually casts a spell in this entire film.
Yeah.
Doesn't do it.
I was saying that during our commentary last night. I'm like, he doesn't even know Expelliarmus in this movie.
Yep. And lastly, the film never explicitly reveals who gave Harry the invisibility cloak at Christmas.
Harry tries to do swish and flick. He tries to do...
but he doesn't do it.
Wingardium Leviosa. No, you're right. Continue.
The film never explicitly reveals who gave Harry the invisibility cloak at Christmas. Of course, in the book, it's said that it was Dumbledore. But in the film, nobody knows. Dumbledore never says it.
Well, that's awkward.
It just shows up. And that is the trivia for today. There's tons more. I'm sure that there is. But yeah. So you know what we'll do is we will take some final listener questions.
Good. Because I'm getting sleepy.
So we'll play the sound.
Oh, Miles here.
All right, so those who are watching this live on the Facebook or on the Twitter, on the Instagram, or on the YouTube, please send us your questions right now. And if you're listening to this on the podcast app, you are not alone. You are not left to your own devices. You can ask us questions. You can get to us. We will answer you either via email or on the podcast itself. Just email maryandblakemedia@gmail.com. with your questions, or go to maryandblake.com and click on the contact button. And if you scroll down, you'll see a whole space where you can just send us a message right from the website.
Whoop, whoop.
So that is that. This is your time. This is your opportunity if you're watching live to ask us any questions that you might have. Ellen asks us, Mary, what do you want to, read it?
Yeah. Ellen, of course, from Australia. Do you think it's a help or a hindrance to the actors being associated with Harry Potter and trying out for new film roles? I can only ever picture them as their Potter characters, even though they have done loads of roles since.
What do you think, Mary?
I think it's a hindrance.
Absolutely. It's kind of like Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia.
Yeah.
Or Mark Hamill as Luke.
I did like, there was a movie that I got to see with Daniel Radcliffe, and he was just this awkward guy trying to date somebody that I loved. It was on Netflix. I'm going to have to find out what it was. It was the only one that I've enjoyed where I forgot that it was Harry, but I think because he was so nerdy and awkward, he was kind of like Harry when he's on Felix Felicis.
Sir. Yeah.
then by all means. yeah, it's, and as I said, I think I said in the last podcast, maybe not, maybe I said it last night. I really want to see the Playmobil movie. It's like the Playmobil movie's version of the Lego movie, and Daniel Radcliffe voices that. I have seen Pretty Women, Little Women.
Yep.
And Beauty and the Beast with Emma Watson.
Rupert Grint has done some stuff.
She did a great job. Like, it's Emma Watson.
Yep. I think she does a good job as Belle.
She does a great job. And she did a great job in Little Women. It's going to take a little while for me to not see them as that. The older actors, the adult actors, though, I see them as other people.
I would agree. Of course, Snape is... If he's not Snape, he's Hans Gruber. So that's what it is. This one comes from Rebecca. She says, would you actually recommend the film to people who decide to not read the book, Mary? Would you say?
For this one, Blake didn't read this book until just now.
That's correct.
So I feel like the movie covers the material that you need to know for the book. So if you're trying to catch people up quickly, or if they've never done anything with the Harry Potter universe, I think that the movie one is totally fine and great as an experience for people who are new.
Which music do you prefer in the Potter universe? John Williams music or the music from later films like Nicholas Hooper, Alexander Desplat, et al?
It depends what mood I'm in.
Yes. If you're in an emo mood, you're going with Alexander Desplat.
Yes. 100%. Like if I'm trying to do like focused, steady, moody music, I'll go on YouTube and I'll do like the Gryffindor common room with the crackling fire. And it's, yeah. Generally,
I am in on Lily's theme in movie 8. Lily's theme in movie 8 is exquisite.
And that's the opening music that they use.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. But you don't have any of that if not for John Williams.
Agreed.
So.
Well, you don't have Lily's. You would have Lily's theme.
Yeah, but that's you can tell that it's inspired by the rest of the music that John Williams did. It just has another signature to it. I would say I think I prefer, honestly, the later films. Mm-hmm. I find them more listenable, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The same way that I kind of feel sometimes that Bear McCreary's music is more listenable than Michael Giacchino's music.
Agreed.
But I like Michael Giacchino more than Bear McCreary.
I think you're right. When it comes to listening music, like music I'm just going to play to like hang out with, I agree, the latter movies. This is the one where you want to feel magical. Mm-hmm. You pop on Sorcerer's Stone.
Absolutely. Like, and that's all of the music for our podcast comes from the Sorcerer's Stone. Like, and that's by design. For as rich as the magical world came across on screen, I felt that this movie is the thinnest of them all in terms of pacing, musical score, editing, and so on. What are your thoughts,
this
Mary?
This is Heather Wilson who said this.
Yes.
I would agree. I think that they had a lot on their plate that they had to cover. They had to create the world and introduce these people. So I think because of that, and you know, this was a very green youngster cast who made up the most of the screen time, knowing that Christopher Columbus had to teach them every single little bit.
They had to stop every take and do every couple of lines.
Please don't look at the camera. Like
right. Emma Watson again. Emma Watson would look at the camera constantly.
Yes, yes. Rupert Grint would laugh constantly.
Right.
I actually was reading that the train scene when the boys are on their way to Hogwarts and they're having the sweets, Rupert and Dan were cracking up so much, they befriended each other so much, that they actually couldn't film it together. So that's why you see it in like one shots. They're not a two shot sitting next to each other. They had to sit and talk with Christopher Columbus for the opposite lines because they kept cracking each other up so much. Jenny Maria
We're forgetting one. This one comes from Tamara. Was it to keep the big three together that they replaced Neville in the forest?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that's fine because there's no midnight duel. There's none of that stuff. Yeah. And including Neville in this would be just too much.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have Norbert bite Ron, so it wouldn't have made sense for him not to be there.
Jenny says, is there something you wish was included in the film that wasn't?
Ooh, what would you think, Blake?
My first and clear thought is Harry being rescued at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. I think that is the one area where the film fails, because that whole portion of the film is what ties in every thematic choice that the book made. The film, I think, does a great job getting there.
Yeah.
It has the roadmap. It condenses things. It compresses them, and that's great. it just doesn't follow through to give me that nice bow that the book did. I'm okay with things being missing. I'm okay with the changes. I think they all were in service to the film. But having Harry not being rescued is a poor choice. The other thing that would I kind of wish was included was all the professor's spells, like it being like McGonagall did the chess and Flitwick did the flying keys and Snape did the potions. That wasn't in the film. And I feel like that's a big portion of what the book is trying to get at. How about you?
I agree. The potions. That's one thing I wanted to see was the potions bit when it comes to the getting to the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah.
Jennifer says, what do you think about the spells guarding the stone being almost tailored to the strings of the trio? Devil's Snare would have been Neville if he was there, but flying for Harry, chess for Ron, logic for the potions for Hermione. Exactly. So since we didn't get to spend so much time with Neville.
Well, Neville wasn't part of the Devil's Snare at all.
No, but Neville's strength is Herbology.
Yes.
So I think that that's what Jennifer is going towards, that do want to get to know Herbology because it is going to play an important thing. Yeah, I think that that's pretty interesting. I did actually read, too, that scene, they were trying to do it with CGI, the Devil's Snare, and they couldn't, so they did, like, you know, little robotic weird things, and it was filmed backwards because it started up already wrapped around them, and then it unraveled.
Tammy asks, which of the Weasley kids would you want to hang out with, Mary?
Charlie.
Why? It's because he's Jon Snow's kid?
Jon Snow?
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
Remember, he's the unborn child of Jon Snow and Ygritte from Game of Thrones?
Yes. I just think Charlie sounds cool. I actually really like Ron. Ron's, yes, he's a little moody, but I dig Ron. Charlie and Ron.
I would want to hang out with Fred and George just because they bust on each other constantly.
You would totally hang out
with them. And all they do is just rank on their mom. I'm not Fred. I'm George.
They would annoy me
too much. That's totally something I would have done.
Oh my gosh. I would be like, okay, guys, I get it.
We were talking about the...
Stop playing pranks on me.
...amount of students at Hogwarts in the commentary track. Kylan Crawford on Facebook says, I looked up how many students at Hogwarts since they were questioning it. We were questioning it during the commentary track. The author said that 1,000 back in the year 2000, but people doing the math based on how many seats at the tables, how many students at the stairs, etc., probably more like 280 altogether.
That would make sense.
That's definitely possible.
Ellen says, do you think Tom Felton did Malfoy justice? I do. I think Tom Felton was, in addition to Rupert Grint, I think he was one of the strongest child actors.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that Harry Potter, you know, like
his sneering.
Yeah, and the way that he just taunts Neville and... Yeah. I think Tom Felton did a great job.
I agree.
All right, the last question we have is from Cassie. She says, which would be your favorite class at Hogwarts?
In the movie? What would you use? Mine would be potions.
Oh, mine would be potions too, just because of Snape.
I think you would stink at potions.
No, I would be terrible at it, but I would love Snape. And just for those of you who
what
are
if
listening,
he didn't like you?
For the sake of posterity.
Here's a question for you. Why was Snape a teacher? Do you think he actually liked children?
No,
do you think, he liked
hated
working
children.
With children?
No.
So why was he a teacher? I think after
some people just that's what they want to do, man.
After seeing the book, the Half-Blood Prince book, like, why wasn't he a potions author? Then he could just hang out at home and write. And, like, try his own stuff and write about it. If Dumbledore doesn't give him the one job that he wants, and he doesn't seem to actually like kids, why is he a teacher?
I don't know.
Are there that few careers for him? I mean, maybe no one would hire him because he used to be a Death Eater. You know, and Dumbledore was like, it's okay, man. I'll just gloss over that part on your resume. I know you.
Yeah, it's fine. Rebecca asks, what if he didn't like you, Blake?
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing.
That would be an issue.
He did not like you.
No, I'd be Snape's
And you homie. Wouldn't have been good at potions, so he might not have liked you.
He would have been my boy. He would have been my boy.
I don't know.
I mean,
if you were in his house,
I would
guess
be head
he'd
boy
give you
at
fine.
Slytherin.
I don't think you would.
I would.
You
I'd
would
be,
not like the responsibilities of head boy. We were describing this in the movie. The
good
kids
point.
Go from wearing basic gray sweaters with a basic
black
tie, and then they get sorted into the houses. And from that moment on, they're wearing house-branded sweaters and ties. So where do these basic sweaters and ties go? They're wearing it on the train. They wear it while they get sorted, and that is the last time they wear these clothes. So I daydreamed that it's property of the school, and that it just is sent on the Hogwarts Express, and that the head boy and girl and the prefects pass them out. Okay, here's your sweater. Here's your tie. Make sure you get dressed. Okay, this is what you have to wear. And then at night, after the kids have been sorted and they put their clothes in the laundry hamper, the house elves come get it and wash it and put it away for the next year's class.
And then they delve out all the rest of the other ties and sweaters and all that.
But as a head boy, would you have been totally fine helping these first years?
No, not at all. Would have hated it. Would have hated every second of it. Hmm. Mo Whitman says, I doubt Snape interviews well. And Rachel actually says something here that's very poignant, and I don't know if she means the kind of poignancy that I'm going to take out of this. She says, I think Snape loved potions. Yes. The way he talks about them, it seems like he has passion for it. And since he couldn't be the
Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Thank you.
You're not down with the Harry Potter...
The acronyms, the DADA. I'm looking at it going, DADA? What the hell's DADA? D-A-D-A, Defense Against the Dark Arts Professor. Potions is next best. And the poignancy that I'm going to take out of this is the way that Snape does talk about it, and really it's Alan Rickman who is doing the speaking. The way that he talks about it is that it is sacred. It is something that I can literally give you everything you've ever wanted if you just aren't idiots. If you listen and you pay attention, I can do anything for you, but you have to do it. I can't do it for you.
Yeah.
And like there is a level of competency, and Rickman makes me believe every ounce that comes out of his mouth.
Well, and it's also something he can control. This is what I frequently talk about as someone who personally struggles with anxiety. I love to do my makeup because it's something I'm in control of. It's actually why I think I loved chemistry so much, and why I think I would love potions, and why I love baking. You can't improvise with baking. The butter has to be cold or room temp, as do the eggs. They're very clear for a particular reason, because if you mess it up, you mess up your potion.
Yep.
But because of that, if you follow things correctly, you will get the end product. There is control over, and so much of Snape's life, his desires, his wanting to be with Lily, his wanting to fit in with the in crowd, and then everything that happened thereafter with Voldemort, he was not in control of, and yet you can control, especially if you have the mental wherewithal, you can control your potions. And Snape even got even better about how to control those potions.
Right, absolutely. All right, Marvin, are you ready to close this bad boy out?
I sure am.
I think so, too. Before we let everybody go, I just want to remind you that we will be doing the Chamber of Secrets on Wednesday. So,
yes,
read the book. Read the first chapter one, tomorrow, so that when we're ready to start talking about it on Wednesday, there will be no breaks. There will be nothing. There will be no stepping back. We're going right into Chamber of Secrets, and that is that. So, got anything else to say? Any final thoughts?
You guys can throw up some snake emojis for a basilisk.
Final question for you, Mary, before we go.
Yeah?
Last question. Okay. Does the movie stand... Like, I always say that the show, yes, Outlander has to stand on its own from the book.
Yes.
Because it has to. Does the film stand on its own from the book in terms of The Sorcerer's Stone?
I completely agree.
It tells its own competent thematic story.
It does, and I think that you are proof of it, Blake, as you have been able to just watch The Sorcerer's Stone up until 2 months ago.
That's a valid point. Touche, Mary.
You're welcome.
Let's close this out.
Thank you, as always, for tuning in, for sharing, for letting other Potter fans know about the Potterverse. Take that time right now to hit that share button. Let other people know that they too can join us for Chamber of Secrets, the read-along each week.
And if you find any value in what we do here at Mary and Blake Media, just go to jointhenerdclan.com, become an official member of the Nerd Clan, where we have a ton of great perks that are all there. Just go to jointhenerdclan.com and you'll see all the perks that are there, including Blake's book club for Midnight Sun and all of the Outlander books. And maybe Mary and I discussed a possible read of Fire and Blood, which is a Game of Thrones book, which will be the basis for the new Game of Thrones series on HBO in about a year or so.
Awesome. All right. So don't forget, jointhenerdclan.com if you're feeling generous and if this brings you joy. For now, my name is Mary.
My name is Blake.
Mischief managed.